Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Welcome back from summer, and for those who observe, happy start to the school year. We have a very large audience today, which I think is because our guest, Lieutenant General David Deptula, U.S. Air Force retired, is bringing us a perspective we don't hear often enough, a view from an American military professional. And more than that, from a group of retired American professionals, sorry, take it back, retired military professionals representing democratic countries and armed forces. We as civilians mostly listen to media, and the media is full of journalists, and I say journalists with quotation marks, and it's full of propagandists. And sometimes those are the same thing. And we do get a lot of good information from the IDF, but in my view, this is something special. Before we get to General Deptula, I'll give you your JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985 as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of both foreign and domestic policies. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Most important, right now, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in their determination to defend the people of Israel and bring the perpetrators of the massacres and the hostage taking to justice. We are an organization that sits slightly to the right of center. We advocate for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can read our insight and in-context articles and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. You can also binge-watch our webinar programs. And now our guest. David Deptula served in the U.S. Air Force for 34 years. During his military career, he took part in operations, planning, and joint warfighting at the unit, major command, service headquarters, and combat and command levels. Before retiring as a lieutenant general, his formal bio doesn't say he retired. His formal bio says he transitioned. And I think that's because for a lot of flag and general officers, they don't retire. And in fact, he has remained in national security research, education, and advocacy. He is the inaugural dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Power Studies, and he built that institution into what has been called the world's leading aerospace power think tank. And if you think about the world today, aerospace power is just huge for our security. He is also a senior scholar at the U.S. Air Force Academy's Center for Character and Leadership Development. He has served on the Defense Science Board and as advisor to NATO. He's testified before Congress many times, and he's shared his expertise with the armful of organizations that populate Washington, looking for better understanding and better ways forward. And most important to us today, he is a member of the high-level military group, HLMG.org, which consists of military leaders and officials from NATO, other democratic countries, exploring the challenges of 21st century warfare. The military group was formed in 2015. I love this. This is my favorite organization, I have to tell you people, to address the implications for Western warfare of fighting enemies who disregard the law of armed conflict, LOAC, as it's called, but exploit our nation's adherence to those laws for their gain. In other words, Hamas or the Taliban or ISIS in Africa. I mean, this is the core of what's going on out there. Countries do adhere to the laws of armed conflict, and other countries or other organizations do not. So he's going to talk to you about the high-level military group, why it was decided that it was important to go to Gaza, and the result of that trip. David Deptula, the floor is yours.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Shoshana, for the very kind introduction, and also for giving me the opportunity to chat with you and the audience today. As Shoshana just explained, she asked me to give you all an overview of just what the high-level military group is all about, why we visited Israel and Gaza in May. So let me jump right in and do that, but and then let you know that I don't intend to speak the whole time. I'll give you this background, and I thought what I would do would kind of explain sort of our conclusions from the trip right up front, and then throw it open to questions, because obviously that's where the most interest lies. Because if I talk forever, I might be going on about something that you really don't care about. So with that, let me jump into a little bit of background. As most of you may know, lawfare is the abuse of international norms and procedures to attain strategic goals that can't be achieved by political or military means. And lawfare, unfortunately, has become a common feature of recent conflicts. It's evolved into a new weapon in the hands of our enemies, who otherwise wouldn't be able to match Western military's conventional warfighting capability. And so they divert or devolve into this particular form of warfare. Now, no case demonstrates the perversion of the international legal system by an adversary better than Hamas's operations against Israel, Hezbollah, the Houthis in Iran included. They're all ultimately part of the same entity or enterprise. Now, no matter how effective and lawful the Israeli Defense Force's conduct, there's always a barrage of allegations against it. So back to this issue of, so what's the high-level military group? First, we're enabled, if you will, by an organization known as the Friends of Israel Initiative. And that group was founded to defend Israel against delegitimization campaigns, not because they felt a moral obligation or a historical debt to Israel, but rather they seek to defend the existence of the state of Israel, because in doing so, they're defending the security and prosperity of the Western world, of which Israel is an integral part. Now, to clarify the conditions under which armed forces must operate today, and to expose the vulnerability that the abuse of international law by our adversary presents to our own militaries, the Friends of Israel Initiative resolved to sponsor some independent studies about just how our militaries can deal with the realities of combat under these conditions. That was the rationale for bringing together in 2015 what's now known as the high-level military group. For it's pretty descriptive of what our group is. It's a group of former senior military leaders from each of the services, Army, Navy, Air Force, from several nations, that originally included Spain, Germany, the United States, United Kingdom, Italy, France, Australia, and India. And our first study was a report on Operation Protective Edge that was carried out by the IDF against Hamas in Gaza in 2014. You can go online, Google Friends of Israel Initiative, and you can get access to that report, which we finished up in 2015. We conducted a second study in 2017, seeking to understand how a war with Hezbollah might erupt and be conducted, and to urge Western leaders that such conflict could be prevented, or should be prevented, by implementing the right policies vis-a-vis Hezbollah and Lebanon. Now, the Friends of Israel's initiative's sole responsibility in all these efforts was to make the necessary means available to the high-level military group to conduct our research, which essentially involves, covering our trips to Israel and Gaza to conduct our research. Now, back to why we went back to Israel and Gaza in May. I think you understand the reason. I mean, since Israel launched its military campaign against Hamas in the wake of the barbarism of October 7th, Israel continues to be vilified in the media as conducting indiscriminate warfare and inhumane treatment of Palestinian civilians. To the degree that international legal tribunals have fueled this narrative by entertaining spurious accusations of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. To most military professionals, these allegations ignore the significance of context in the assessment of legality and legitimacy of a military campaign. So gaining a better understanding of that context is what led us on another fact-finding mission to Israel as part of this high-level military group. And that 1 week in July provided us with important insights into the operational military realities that are widely misunderstood or ignored by those who posit that Israel and its defense forces are engaged in an illegal campaign. Instead, that visit confirmed for us the exact opposite, that the Israeli Defense Forces have executed a military campaign defined by tactical excellence and an overall commitment to the law of armed conflict. In fact, these conclusions are the foundations for an amicus brief that was filed by our group challenging the request to the International Criminal Court to secure arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister and Minister of Defense. Now look, preserving the freedom of action of our military personnel when conducting their missions has been a paramount feature of warfare in the past. But the enemies we're facing today are very different from the ones most of us fought in our experiences, and the realities on the ground tend to differ to the combat that we tried to tame and regulate through the laws of war. So with that as background, let me pause there first before I go in and discuss kind of my conclusions up front, and then we can go there to your questions. But first, any questions about the High Level Military Group or Friends of Israel Initiative before I proceed?
Well, would you talk about the letter that you gave, or the brief that you gave to the ICC? I think there are some people who know that you did it. What kind of response did you get? Did they say anything to you? Have they talked to you?
Well, in the context of, look, they accepted the brief, which is, you know, which is very positive in that regard. So they were willing to listen to what we presented, and I'm happy to, you know, to post what we sent online.
That would be great.
Or I'm sorry, to send to the to send you, and you can distribute accordingly.
Great.
But other than accepting what we had presented, you know, I've not heard of any other specifics.
But they could have refused. It wouldn't be likely, but is it possible for the court to refuse to take?
I'm not a lawyer, although I did spend a night in a Holiday Inn Express last night. I mean, you have to ask our lawyers in the group that question, Shoshana. I hate to give you an answer that's not legally correct. We submitted the brief. They accepted the brief. Okay. I'm sure they didn't have to, but, you know, I don't know. I'm a military guy.
Well, then let's stick with that.
Okay.
So all right, tell us then.
Yeah, let me give you a rundown of kind of our two. The group really left with two overriding impressions, and then we can throw it open to questions to the crowd, or I'm happy to talk some more and give you some of my impressions. But our two sort of takeaways are: number one is the disconnect between the reality that we observed in the public perception of Israeli military operations is truly unfortunate. It's not anticipated because, by the way, and this is a whole nother subject area, the whole issue of information operations and perception management is at play here. But many of these perceptions are based on a combination of intentional disinformation, misunderstanding of military operational realities, and anti-Semitism. And to be fair, unacceptable rhetoric by some Israeli government officials that made this issue even more complex. So ineffective external messaging by Israel has also contributed to this disconnect. Most significantly, however, we think it's primarily the result of fighting an enemy that never sought military victory, but instead sought to use the narrative of civilian casualty excess as its primary ammunition for a strategic information campaign to discredit and isolate Israel. I'm reminded of one of the IDF commander's response when we asked him why Hamas fighters continue to resist when the outcome seems already predetermined. And his response was something like this: look, their goal was never to defeat us in battle, rather it was to inflict pain on us and on civilians to pressure us to stop prematurely. So if you unpack that statement, you see what's unfolding kind of matches exactly that. And I think really to summarize it, for the Israeli Defense Forces and most militaries, information is a supporting effort to combat. But for Hamas, combat is a supporting effort to information. So Hamas has exploited false assumptions and distorted narratives to great effect in their delegitimization campaign. And countering this is no easy task, but it's got to be, it's got to begin with more effective explanations of the reality of combat against such a capable and adaptive enemy. Now, second, our concern is just how this Hamas playbook may be replicated by future enemies of democratic states, because those enemies are learning that the most effective way to turn the public against a righteous war is to create conditions that maximize, not reduce, civilian casualties. Unless people understand that when fighting an enemy who has no regard for its own civilians, who often put civilians in harm's way, responsibility for those casualties lies at the feet of the illicit enemy, civilians will be in greater risk than ever before. Even worse, the armed forces tasked to achieve specific military effects may find themselves hobbled by those who are incapable of drawing the distinction between the bomb that caused the casualty and the enemy who is truly responsible for that suffering. So let me stop there and kind of open this up to questions. There's so many things that I could talk about that have an impact on these conclusions and also kind of what's going on today, which are just, you know, having been over there, having witnessed what's going on, this notion that seems to be flying around the media, particularly prevalent on the news. Now, look, part of the news is, and I say news with parentheses because it's not news, it's propaganda, and some of the people who should know better are repeating it instead of highlighting what's going on, is just absolute ignorance of the things that we see in here, which are completely 180 out from what's actually going on. And this call, and forgive me, I said I wasn't going to talk, but you know, the apparent equivalency that it just appalling, and I'm sorry, you know, running a think tank, I try to maintain a impartial political perspective, but to have the president of the United States get on TV and imply that there's some sort of equivalency in the vice president between Hamas and the Israeli government is just absolutely horrific. And it's playing exactly into the hands of all of our adversaries, and is providing aid and comfort to the enemies of civilization. I know that's a strong comment, but I believe it's true, and it's extraordinarily unfortunate. So having violated what I said I wouldn't do, let me throw it open to questions. I see that there are some Q&A. Shoshana, I'll leave it up to you to do the moderation, but I'm you know, I'm used to the Zoom thing, so I'm happy to.
No, it's okay. I'll go through the questions, and we've got some lined up already. And based on something that you said, I mean, all of this information warfare is designed to, as you said, inflict pain on Israel. And it works because the UK government has suspended arms shipments of certain weapons to Israel. And the US has done a little foot dragging here on certain deliveries to Israel. And it seems to me that this may be the first time in a very long time that Western powers have made a decision to make Israel pay for what's going on here. Is that right? Do you remember others?
No, I think it is unique, although look, nothing in here. If you go back and you do explore enough there, you can find a situation where there's something similar, but not in recent history. The frustration with limiting weapons, particularly what the United States did, was, you know, limiting 2,000-pound bombs was counterproductive. And in part of this is the ignorance that resides on the National Security Council staff, or at least in their leadership, in imposing these kinds of restrictions. In the particular case that I'm familiar with, the United States restricted 2,000-pound penetrating munitions. Well, guess what? You know, and they supposedly, ostensibly did that to, you know, reduce the impact on civilian casualties. In reality, the opposite was the case. Because with 2,000-pound penetrating munitions is what you use to get to the underground tunnels without having to dig through the surface. And so the opposite was the case. If you restrict the high-yield weapons that have penetrating capability, now you have to use many, many more numerous smaller weapons to dig down to get into the tunnels, which create a greater exposure to civilian casualties than if you'd provided them with penetrating munitions in the first place.
So you answered the follow-up question.
It is extraordinarily incredible that, I mean, obviously there are people in the Department of Defense that can explain this to the members of the National Security Council, but evidently, you know, Jake Sullivan and the folks over there didn't incorporate that information, or that information was overridden. And here's the other part that's extraordinarily concerning, is the decisions that are coming out of the White House are driven by the election and political pandering to perceptions of groups out there and how it'll affect the votes. That is disgusting.
So we try to stay away from electoral politics, but I think you put your finger on it. What? And you answered the follow-up question, which is, when countries do that sort of thing, restricting as the UK is doing and as the US has done, they're actually increasing, first of all, the length of the war, and second, the potential for casualties, both civilian and military.
Correct.
That's where we are. Now, here's a question that came from a listener. You mentioned something called the IDF fact-finding and assessment mechanism. Knowing that every military makes mistakes, knowing that every military does a certain number of things that cause casualties they didn't intend or more casualties than they thought about. Can you talk to us about this IDF fact-finding and assessment mechanism? I, for one, had never heard of it.
Yeah, this is one of the things that is extraordinarily incredible about the Israeli Defense Forces is that they understand exactly what's going on, and at the same and as a result, they're looking. Like any military, let me, it's a, look, it's complex, but the fact of the matter is they have processes and procedures that are in place that by the fact that they're in place in the first place are indicative that the Israeli Defense Force complies with the laws of armed conflict. And then in those cases where there may be a question of misconduct or errors in force application, those are then investigated by a judicial arm of the Israeli Defense Forces as separate from the chain of command, and legal action appropriate to the case can be applied if, in fact, it's required. So the bottom line is IDF personnel are legally held accountable for their actions, and you know, Israel employ these measures, by the way, not just to comply with international law. But they understand that whenever hostilities end, they're going to still be living with the Palestinians as their neighbors. So it just makes good sense. So that organization is part of the overall effort to make sure that what they do and how they do it is conducted in accordance with the laws of armed conflict.
Do we do that as well?
I'm sorry?
Do we do that as well in the US military? Do we have those kind, let's say in Iraq or in Afghanistan when we were there, were we watching those things as well?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, let me not make a look. I've been personally involved in targeting and building war plans in which we had Judd Advocate General on the staff. But every military officer is in, you know, deeply trained and in understands the laws of armed conflict, what can and cannot be done. Look, there are differences among militaries. I would tell you that the IDF does this to a degree probably more than any other military in the world.
Good to know. So you talk about tunnels and 2,000-pound bombs might have made it simpler, neater, cleaner, faster to do it. But now Israel is in Rafah and they've discovered all these smuggling tunnels running from Egypt to Gaza. When you were down there the second time, did you go to Rafah? And can you talk about what you learned was going on at Rafah? Because the big question now appears to be, well, at least on the American side, the question is, how do we get the Israelis out of Rafah? And I'm not sure the Israelis are going to go.
Yeah, look, it's a wonderful question. I tend not to want to get into tactical level details simply because, you know, the people who are on the ground who are conducting the operations there are the ones who have the greatest knowledge about that. However, all that
Yeah.
said, excuse me, I'll tell you, yeah, let me answer your question. I mean, the highlight of this trip, because look, we met with the President Herzog, we met with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, we met with leaders from each one of the services. But the highlight of the trip was actually going into Gaza, and you know, it wasn't just we put our foot across the border and then left. But the fact of the matter is, we entered in the south. We drove the entirety of the Philadelphia corridor. We went to the Mediterranean. We stopped there. We had discussions with the deputy brigade commander. We went with the deputy division commander, and then we came back. So, you know, we drove through the outskirts of Rafah on the southern side. and a couple of observations that are relevant to your question. One of the places that we stopped and witnessed was with an engineering team who started at the Mediterranean with the goal of going all the way back to the border of Gaza, Egypt, and in Israel on the other side. And obviously they have modern technology and techniques to detect tunnels, but at the end of the day, they still drill holes to verify that the tunnels are there. And on average, that engineering unit has been finding two tunnels per day.
Wow.
Between Egypt and Gaza. Now, not all of them are tunnels used by Hamas. Some of them are used by criminal gangs simply, you know, to capitalize on blackmail sales of materials flowing from Egypt to Gaza. But the majority of them are associated with Hamas, and this is how they get their goods and military supplies from Egypt into Gaza, which directly leads to some of the items that the Israeli government is insisting on in any kind of a ceasefire. And that's that, no, we're not leaving the Philadelphia corridor. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, are you kidding me? Why would you? You don't have to be, you know, an occupation force inside the city of Rafah, but my goodness, it's just common sense that you would want to have a presence along the Egyptian Gaza border to ensure that, you know, that this smuggling of arms wouldn't continue to support or supply Hamas. I mean, that's kind of common sense 101. So I'll pause there and see if that answered your question.
That answered my question, but it prompted a question from someone who's listening, who says, you're an air power guy. Can you do Rafah? Can you properly patrol Rafah with drones? Is it possible to do it technologically, or do you have to have boots on the ground?
Well, look, it's a great question. Yeah, I am an advocate for how to best exploit air and space power in the conduct of joint military operations. And I think that's an extraordinarily important piece. It is all about what joint warfare is all about. And by the way, and I don't want to get into too much detail here, because the Israeli Defense Forces are not organized along the lines that the U.S. is, with combatant commands and separate services. But the way they actually fight is very much along the lines of integrating each of the capabilities that are provided in the domains of air, space, seas, cyberspace. So the short answer to the question is no, you can't do it all from the air. You need to have, particularly in this case, people on the ground monitoring what's going on. You know, you can't dig a tunnel with a drone, okay? You can monitor activity, but you can't monitor activity in structures that hide tunnel entrances with a drone, unless you go inside that structure with a drone, which is becoming more and more possible. But regardless, to control the situation in the immediate situation, you're going to need people there to monitor what's going on.
Okay. So let's take a step back to a slightly broader question. People often talk about finishing the war in Gaza. I mean, many Israelis do. They talk about finishing Gaza because they need to deal with Hezbollah in the north. But finishing is finishing victory. Did you hear anybody talk about a victory in Gaza and what that would look like? I'm trying to figure out what would be sufficient to create the conditions for Israel that make its people secure and make Hamas not able to rearm itself. Is there such a thing as victory under the circumstances?
It's an extraordinarily important question. It's not victory in the context that one saw in the end of World War II, where there's a surrender document signed and, okay, everything is over and now we're going to proceed to rebuild and establish a new environment. I don't see that happening. I see a continuation of the need for Israel in some fashion to be able to monitor what's going on in Gaza, to assure that the horrendous actions that occurred on October 7 does not happen again. How that evolves, I don't know. I wouldn't purport to know, although I would suggest and do know that I certainly would not trust Hamas.
I don't think the Israelis do either, so I guess we're all on the same page. How the United States deals with that, though, is a different matter. And that goes back to something you said in your introductory remarks. You talked about the Houthis, for example, and Hezbollah. And I think it's become very clear to anybody who wants to know that the guiding hand here, the puppet master here, is Iran. And so I want to sort of lift our eyeballs for a minute from the small war that's going on in Gaza to the potential for a much broader war. Do we have to do something about Iran? And I say we advisedly because I suspect that's the kind of job the United States would have to do and not any smaller country. So how do you feel about the role of Iran? And if you look at this as a military person, can it be handled on an individual front like Gaza, or does it have to go big time?
When you say does it have to go big time, I think you're absolutely correct in understanding, you know, look, here's the fact of the matter. Hamas is only one element of an alliance of evil. Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, radical Islamic militias in Iraq and Syria and Iran. So collectively, ultimately, these terrorist strongholds must be dismantled. Or contained. But the sooner the world's free of the scourge of these factions, the sooner the people subjugated by them can be free and the world can become a better place. How you do that is extraordinarily challenging. And it is something that has perplexed the United States administration, several of them, for decades now. However, it's quite clear that and for the life of me, I cannot understand some of the actions of the current and previous, not previous, but the current administration with respect to trying to deal with Iran as if they were mirror images of people in the United States. They're not. And that has to be recognized as a first step. And then a cohesive set of strategic objectives need to be put in place in how to deal with Iran. Now, I think, and look, these people understand power. And you know, you don't know whether you've deterred someone for quite a while. But it does appear that some of the most recent actions in deploying forces, U.S. forces to the region, as well as I'm sure behind the scenes diplomatic actions have gone a long way to discouraging Iran from taking any lethal action as a result of some of the most recent activities. But we'll see. Again, that's not a satisfying answer, but the fact of the matter is, yes, Iran has to be dealt with. They're ultimately the puppet master. They're also the ones that provide the resources for the triple H's, if you will, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis, to operate. And how that's done is not just a singular government operation, but it's a multinational effort that involves all the affected countries in the region, to include the Saudis and other Arab nations in the Gulf states, as well as Israel.
Do you think that the Gulf states and Saudi and I know Israel expect us to have a plan, want us to have a plan? How much faith do they have in us? I mean, this is a real American question.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. I think over the past 4 years, that faith has been degraded significantly, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. You look at how effective Putin's rhetoric has been in deterring administration support for Ukraine. I know folks have different perspectives on that, but from a military perspective, and someone who's studied history and participated in it, I think that the deterrent capacity of the United States has been significantly degraded by actions of the current administration that have been perceived by our adversaries, rightly or wrongly, as weakness. And that has to change. And perhaps, hopefully, either of the candidates would recognize that and take action. But, you know, that's yet to be determined.
So I'm going to take one big leap here over to Taiwan, because I know you worked on a little study for some people on Taiwan. If I were the Taiwanese watching the Middle East right now, I would have grave concerns. A, do you think they do? And B, do you think China's going, oh, yes, let's keep going here? I mean, how much of this has an impact in a place like Taiwan and China?
I think it's got enormous impact. I mean, the Chinese are watching everything that's going on. And, you know, I would not be surprised to see them act sooner rather than later in their designs to exert greater control over Taiwan. Now, I selected those words very carefully because, you know, they don't need, look, part of the Chinese perspective, I traveled to China in 2019, spent almost 2 weeks there. And it was an interesting trip for a variety of reasons, but one of my big takeaways was just how emotional the issue of Taiwan impacts the people on mainland China, and particularly the government. But I digress. Let me get back to your question.
That's okay. Digression is okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's watching what's going on. You know, all indications point to President Xi, if he wants to take action against Taiwan and not expect any significant U.S. response other than a strongly worded statement and you know, maybe a resolution introduced in the Security Council of the UN. And we know how meaningless those have become.
Yes. Okay, so let's bring us back then to the Middle East. Although I don't consider that a digression at all, frankly. I mean, U.S. policy has an impact on all the things we've talked about in the Middle East. But going straight back to the Middle East, I don't know if you guys had an opportunity to go to Judea and Samaria, to the West Bank, and to think about that. You didn't. Okay.
No.
Because we have a question here.
It's only so many hours in the day.
And so many days in the week.
Yep.
Because the question is about small spaces, you know, and for people who present this idea of a two-state solution, essentially it's three states. It's the West Bank, it's Gaza, and it's Israel, because Israel's in between the other two. When you look at a space that small, how does that strike you? You're an American military officer. We have a huge country, and we have oceans on both sides, and we have friends in the north and friends in the south. When you look at Israel, or look at just Gaza, if you didn't do the Judea and Samaria, is it possible to live next door to somebody in those kinds of close quarters if they arm against each other?
Is it possible to live if they're
both armed and they're both not happy with each other? My guess is Israel will be armed forever. It is. It's going to be.
Well,
But
even more so in the context of what happened. I mean, part of what I didn't describe to your audience is that part of our trip, we had the opportunity to visit a couple of the sites of the atrocities that were committed.
oh.
You know, one of the kibbutzes that was close by, you know, had 400 inhabitants, 125 were massacred. We went and we visited the site of the music festival, and we visited a couple other places. And you know, the impact of that, the atrocities that were committed, the other briefings we got in terms of the sexual violence that was perpetrated on these innocent human beings, you kind of take away a disgust, and it has an absolute impact on one that you can't get from just reading about it in the newspapers, which again is a tribute to the Israeli Defense Forces and how they conduct their operations. Because it is extraordinary the amount of discipline that they exert. And by the way, another point that one does not hear about in the media is, and maybe your audience is aware, but it wasn't just members of Hamas that committed these atrocities. There were over 4,000 people that invaded Israel on October 7th. And many of them were Palestinian citizens that also participated. So I guess the point is, Israel, I believe every citizen, regardless of what they might believe in the with respect to current negotiations, understands the significance of what happened and is committed never again to let it happen. So yeah, it's going to be difficult if there are armed groups, but that's part of the impetus behind the current Israeli government approach in their insistence that Hamas has to be disabled.
Disarmed, disabled, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so this leads to another question. You have seen the worst of all things. And Israel is fighting a much longer war than either it's fought before, or I think longer than it expected to fight. And a lot of Israeli soldiers have now been killed, as well as hostages and civilians. What's the morale like in Israel? What did you hear from the IDF?
It's a great question, and I think I was amazed. I can remember standing there on the ground in Hamas, talking to the deputy brigade commander, who had been involved in operations since the Israelis went into Gaza toward the end of October. And this guy was still motivated. Very clearly laid out the challenges in fighting in Gaza. But also, and by the way, the other thing that was really impressive in talking to him is he really described how the IDF is integrating forces from the air, sea, land, space, in conducting their operations in a truly integrated fashion that I haven't seen in the United States. Okay, and again, I've participated in Operation Desert Storm, no fly zones over Iraq. I was there to design the initial response to the attacks at 9/11 as the Air and Space Center commander in 2001, did the planning, Taiwan contingency planning in the Pacific. Look, I've been involved in a lot of this stuff. But this guy really didn't care whether systems came from their Air Force, Army, Navy. He was interested in what kind of effects, how can I use these different capabilities to achieve our overarching objective. And that's what jointness and integration is all about, which takes me back to your original question about what is the morale and motivation. They understand the significance of what happened. They're committed to making sure that it doesn't happen again. And yeah, it's a long, arduous process, but morale is still there because they understand that the adversaries that they're fighting are committed to their elimination. And so this is an existential set of operations that are occurring, and members of the IDF understand that.
So the IDF understands it, and apparently much of the world does not understand.
Yeah, that's the frustration. And what is appalling is the ignorance and manipulation that's occurring on campuses in the United States of America. It's absolutely despicable. And it speaks to the failure of our national education system as well. And, you know, throw in there some manipulation by adversaries.
And money.
Oh, yeah.
And money. You've got money flowing in there that probably shouldn't be allowed in this country. Okay, so we're coming to the end of the program. And people who listened know that I like to go out on a positive note. And I thought we were there. We were there with the IDF and its morale, but we sort of fell off the edge with thinking about college campuses, which is not a positive thought at the moment. Let me go one negative, one positive. Say a few words about the Gaza Pier, which has cost U.S. taxpayers somewhere around $320 million. That's probably your down note. And the up note is, as you leave Israel or left Israel, and as you think about where you've been, how do you see Israel for the long term? Is it a plus? Is it a minus? Are we okay? Are they okay?
Yeah, let me start with the pier first. Look, it was a laudable effort by the United States to provide humanitarian assistance, which, by the way, you know, that was one of the things that was very evident as well. I mean, we spoke to the individual who's responsible for coordinating humanitarian access, who described to us the variety of ways in which they're providing food and other humanitarian aid. And again, sure, in the early days of this conflict, that was not the highest element in the discussion space, but as time went on, it did. And so today, the Israeli Defense Forces are doing their best to provide more than sufficient food to maintain every Gazan's ability to support their daily needs. Now, that doesn't mean that food insecurity, that whole issue has been solved, because food insecurity does remain a challenge. Right. But that's mainly because Hamas and criminal gangs continue to hijack and steal relief supplies. But that was a positive effort to try to assure that humanitarian aid was getting to where it needed to be. Right. Okay. Now, with respect to Israel in the long term, you know, I'm a glass half full kind of guy, and I think the Israeli people are resolute. On balance, they understand the significance of what happened and the need to assure that it never happens again. There are disagreements on how to proceed in the near term, but I think ultimately they will resolve those disagreements and move forward to assure a better position for themselves, as well as all the people concerned in both the West Bank as well as Gaza. Yeah, by the way, and you know, when I'm talking to the to the people on the ground there, the IDF personnel, they're very cognizant of the fact that, look, they're going to have to live with the population of Gaza in the future. So it's not like this is what's so absurd about some of these charges of that are just unsustainable or unsubstantiation and can't be sustained or verified. with respect to, you know, heinous activities that they've been accused of. No, just the opposite is the case. They're doing everything they can to protect civilians. But remember, you got an adversary that's doing everything they can to maximize civilian casualties. And that's what the rest of the world simply refuses to understand.
So that's an optimistic and a pessimistic note. On the optimistic side, I would point out that 74,000 children were vaccinated yesterday with the polio vaccine because Israel made that happen, not because Hamas
did. Right.
But on that note, I want to thank you, David Deptula, for a fabulous, fabulous presentation. You've brought us tons of information. I love getting it from an American source. I love getting it from an American military source. Thank you very much for your time and for all the good work that you do. Thank you.
Thanks very much, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.